Well, today we have an opportunity to talk about something that's on everybody's mind, apparently, and that is the Dietary Guidelines Report. It's been talked about for a long time, and now in newspapers and TV shows and online, it's announced that it's out, that the dietary guidelines are out. What exactly that is and what it means to maybe even the average person in the United States, we're going to chat about that today. And I'm going to talk about it with my friend Sharon Palmer, who's a registered dietitian. She's the editor of Environmental Nutrition, and she's also an author. She's written books. Sharon, this has been a long time coming. How do you explain to somebody what really is the dietary guidelines?
Well, the dietary guidelines are really the culmination of a group of nutrition experts that are called together, and they're tasked at looking at all of the evidence, all of the nutrition research that we've gathered over the years, and look at what the latest findings are, and then try to put all of this together, looking at the health of Americans. You know, what are our disease risks? What kinds of problems do we have? What are our eating patterns like? So they use all of this information, and they try to put together a list of dietary recommendations for optimal health. So this is a huge process. It's there's a lot of research that goes into it, and the initial thing that happens is something called the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee Report, which is really a scientific report. It's like, you know, 100 pages or more, and it really is what feeds into the dietary guidelines, which are kind of a more abbreviated list of diet recommendations.
Well, this was started, it looks like what, almost 20 years ago, that it and they were instructing these agencies to do this every 5 years. Well, did they just think that things keep changing and maybe health needs change or new science would come out and they wanted to be sure that there was an official update? Is that the reason that these guidelines were ordered to take place every 5 years?
Yes, because, you know, there was a realization that our understanding of nutrition science changes, and also our eating behavior and our health problems change. So over the years, you know, when I first became a dietitian, obesity wasn't such an issue. So the dietary guidelines were not focusing so much on obesity. They were focusing more on things like heart health. But then our understanding of nutrition science changes and it evolves. So by getting this committee together every 5 years, then we can take a fresh look at the science, a fresh look at what our problems are, and then, you know, create this set of guidelines. And another thing is that they're very specific to Americans. You know, they identify what our pitfalls are, what nutrients we're missing in our diets. So, you know, this is something that's very specific to our population and what we can do to have better health.
How do they decide who they're going to listen to? I mean, when they name a guidelines committee every 5 years, how do they choose who's going to be on this committee to come up with advice? Because I'm sure there's always suggestions that one or the other of the appointees are biased or coming with a preconceived notion or have an agenda and so forth. It must be pretty political. How do they come up with these names?
Yeah, I'm not really sure about the exact process of how these experts are chosen. I mean, it's very, you know, it's transparent. The information is always on the Dietary Guidelines website. When the committee is formed, you know, the people that are on the committee, they're leading nutrition experts across our country. So this, you know, they're chosen for this position. And then that, you know, the evidence is weighed. So, for example, all the research that comes in, they weigh it in terms of the quality of the research, you know, so that they're really looking at whether the studies are human studies or how well designed they are. And all of this analysis, this evidence analysis, goes into creating, you know, these overall recommendations.
And they all seem to, each time these come out, they seem to have either a theme or a big story. I guess after you wait 5 years, there should be some sort of big story. But it seems that happens, that they've got something that pops out. What really pops out of this report? What stands out as being the biggest stories from this dietary guidelines report?
Well, you're right, because there are new themes. You know, for example, in the last 5 years, a lot of nutrition experts are putting criticism on the focus on nutrients over foods. You know, like the dietary guidelines had too much of an emphasis on nutrients, and we don't eat nutrients alone, we eat food. So this last, go-around, the last revision, there was more emphasis on food, eating patterns, because, again, we don't eat food in isolation either. We eat in a pattern. So this time they actually have examples of healthy eating patterns. They listed three specific examples of research-based healthy eating patterns, one being the U.S. Healthy Diet, which is kind of like the DASH diet, another one being the Mediterranean diet, and then another one being the vegetarian diet. So that was one big standout this time.
Well, let me stop you for a second, because I think these acronyms can throw a lot of us off if they're not in it all the time. But I want to get back even to the basic of what's an example of nutrients. When you said that, you know, that they're looking for patterns versus nutrients, or what would the average person recognize as being nutrients?
So sometimes, you know, we talk about dietary recommendations, and all we do is focus on, like, for instance, we talk about saturated fat. That's a nutrient. Mm. But the food would be something like meat or coconut or something like that would contain the saturated fat. Another thing is cholesterol. You know, that's another thing that happened this time around, is there's no recommendation for reducing cholesterol. But, you know, eggs are something that contain cholesterol. So, you know, there's a bigger interest in talking about food rather than just the nutrients they contain, such as something like vitamin C in oranges. Let's talk about eating more fruits rather than talking about eating more vitamin C. So those are kind of examples.
Well, and vitamin C is also a nutrient.
Exactly, exactly. And the food would be fruit. Fruit is really a big contributor of vitamin C. So if we have a shortfall in a particular nutrient, let's talk about, like, food, what foods we should eat, which really applies to what people put on their plate every day rather than this isolated nutrient.
So I kind of wonder if they shouldn't have apologized to these egg producers across the country for some of the previous dietary guidelines that were saying cut back on dietary cholesterol and so don't eat so many eggs, because they actually did have that in some of the earlier dietary guidelines, didn't they?
Yes, and this is a little bit of a controversial area, because they cut out the recommendation for cholesterol reduction this time, because if you reduce saturated fat, like they do recommend, to eat no more than 10% of your calories from saturated fat, you will automatically trim cholesterol from your diet. So that is, you know, they did make that clear in this version of the dietary guidelines, is that if you're doing what we tell you to do, cholesterol won't be a problem. And then, in addition, the newer research shows that there's not such a direct association with cholesterol in the diet and cholesterol levels, you know, blood cholesterol levels. So those are a couple of things. But, you know, there is a bigger picture, and it's, you know, I recommend that people still eat eggs in moderation. And there is still some research showing, like, people who have a risk, particularly like people who have diabetes, should probably keep their egg intake in a moderate level. It doesn't mean that we should start eating 3 egg omelets every day. But, you know, in terms of the guidelines, you know, they're looking at since the saturated fat is really kind of the gatekeeper for cholesterol, then we won't talk about it anymore.
So, and just one more thing about eggs. When you say moderately, is that like an egg a day instead of a 3 egg omelet, or...
Yeah, I think a lot of people are talking about, you know, try to keep it to one a day. If you have a higher risk, you know, I've seen recommendations like more like 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, again, it's a little bit controversial right now. So
it doesn't solve, or I mean, it doesn't, I guess it solve all the questions or all the problems. So So when they publish this report, there still is some controversy around it because things are still being thrashed out and debates still are taking place, I guess. And,
right.
And you were saying that there are patterns, and even choosing the patterns, you were saying that the diets, a Mediterranean diet, which many people have heard of a Mediterranean diet, and probably most have an idea of what that is, and we might go ahead and explain that. But I think a lot of people don't know what a DASH diet is. You mentioned the DASH diet is one they suggested was a good diet pattern. What is a DASH diet?
Yes, well, the dietary guidelines outlines one healthful diet pattern. They call it the U.S. Healthy Eating Pattern, and it's very similar to the DASH diet. And the DASH diet stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. This was a really healthy diet pattern that the researchers started looking at to prevent hypertension or to treat hypertension. And they found it to be very successful. But then they also found that this diet worked for other things like heart disease and reducing the risk of type 2 diabetes because it's a really healthy eating pattern. It includes, you know, lean protein sources. It includes dairy products. It includes lots of fruits and vegetables and whole grains. It's like the way we teach people to eat, you know. So this is kind of this U.S. healthy eating pattern. It's very rich in nutrients, it's low in saturated fat, and it's low in sodium. So that's kind of like a little brief description of that diet.
Well, you mentioned there are three examples that they gave, and I would think those examples are also a little bit controversial. You explained DASH very well. We still come around to Mediterranean, but you also mentioned a vegetarian diet. And that's something that I would have thought 20 years ago, I'm not sure they would have suggested that as an alternative, maybe because it was less mainstream vegetarian diets at that time. It's understandable. I mean, I think a vegetarian diet probably doesn't need much explanation to most people. But let's try to clarify a little bit more. Can a vegetarian diet include eggs?
Yes, so the vegetarian diet pattern that they recommended does include an option for eggs. And the reason that they identified this is because they really looked at diet patterns that have evidence behind benefits. So here we have research on the DASH diet, and we have research on the vegetarian diet providing benefits, and this wasn't available 20 years ago. Now we have all these new findings that show that vegetarian-style diets have lots of health benefits, lower risk of heart disease, certain types of cancer, type 2 diabetes, obesity. So that is why they actually recommended it as one healthy eating pattern. So it does include options for dairy products, eggs, soy foods are in there, nuts, whole grains, legumes, lots of fruits and vegetables.
Well, and then the final of those three, we get back to the Mediterranean diet. And in that case, we're talking more fish and nuts and vegetables, leafy greens. Is that right?
Yes, and the Mediterranean diet is another healthy eating pattern with a lot of research evidence behind its benefits. So in that diet, you explained it perfectly. It's a diet that's very traditional in the Mediterranean region, and the common characteristics is that fish is the major animal protein, very little meat, mostly fish. Legumes, whole grains, lots of fruits and vegetables, healthy fats, avocados, nuts, seeds, olive oil, moderate red wine. So those are kind of like the similarity in the Mediterranean diet.
Well, the old meat and potatoes American diet, this kind of a stereotypical American diet before it became viewed as the fast food diet, but the old stereotypical American diet was like meat and potatoes, you know, meatloaf, green beans, mashed potatoes and gravy, and a side of iceberg lettuce and a big glass of milk. It's hard to see that old-fashioned diet as into one of these three tracks. Is that
right? Yeah, and, you know, furthermore, the dietary guidelines are translated into My Plate, which is this little visual graphic. And only one-fourth of the plate is the protein food. So in your example of like meat and potatoes, you could still have the lean meat as long as it's, you know, leaner meat, but it's only 1/4 of the plate. So, and then the 3/4 of the plate is filled with plant foods, things like whole grains, those potatoes, you know, green vegetables, red vegetables, yellow, all the different colors. So it's just kind of, are we shifting the portion size of the plate so that there's more emphasis on the other things?
Well, and yet the overall issue, I mean, the bigger issue that then this doesn't even address is that people feel like Americans are a lot less healthy. There's a lot more obesity. There's more diabetes. So it's kind of a mess in the country right now. And some of it's blamed for, you know, the need for convenience, and you want fat, salt, and sugar, and sometimes going to the quick service restaurants, people have no alternative. And if they can get a dollar value meal, they go, they're in a hurry, they're pressed for time, they're pressed for money. And you know, it's hard for me to envision how people that are on that kind of a treadmill, if you will, can pay a lot of attention to the dietary guidelines. I mean, isn't that still the challenge, is that people are eating unhealthy not because they don't know the difference between French fries and broccoli? Because I doubt if there's anybody in America that doesn't realize that it's better if you ate broccoli than eat French fries. But for all these other reasons, it's apparently hard for people to make the shift.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of like going from day-to-day life to this kind of a theory of what we should eat. And I agree with you. You know, most of our problems in terms of our, you know, preventable diseases such as type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and obesity is related to our diet, which we call the Western diet. That's a typical diet in America. And it's an industrial diet. It's very high in meat. It's very high in processed grains like white flour, very high in sugar, high in salt. And it's very low in things like fruits and vegetables and whole grains and beans. So that's what got us into the trouble that we're in, the highly processed foods that we're consuming. So really, if you look at the overall main tenets of the dietary guidelines, it's really eating more vegetables, and they really made an emphasis of all the different colors, not just potatoes and cauliflower, although those are healthy choices, but really having a variety of different kinds of vegetables. We're falling way short on all of them, and then having more fruits, and then making at least half of the grains we choose to be whole grain, and then having a variety of protein foods, not just the same thing, having a couple servings of seafood a week, having more legumes, which are like beans and lentils, and then healthier fat choices, things like healthy oils instead of saturated fat. And that's really the main bulk of the guidelines.
Well, that's very interesting, and I have to make a sidebar comment on that, and that is when you talk about this as being the Western diet of where we are right now, and we're trying to have it evolve in this other direction, but it just strikes me that it may have to rename it from the Western diet, since our Western diet is moving to the East, and more and more in Asia and the Southern Hemisphere are following our footsteps and having similar diets to the one we're discussing should be changed. I want to kind of, now coming back then to the major takeaway, it seems like in the past, I think in fact the immediate past dietary guidelines 5 years ago, salt really was emphasized. This time, isn't it sugar that is really coming out as with the strongest emphasis as to where they need to be focusing attention?
Yeah, I think this is the first time they actually put a cap on sugar at 10% of calories. So they still have a guideline for keeping sodium to 2,300 milligrams a day, which has kind of been the same for a while. But this is the first time they talk about reducing sugar to 10% of our total calories. And this is kind of goes along with what the American Heart Association has been saying, So this is, it is a big emphasis this time.
So what does that mean to, say, the average person? If they had, you know, a can of cola a day, would a can of, and it's not sugar-free cola, but the full sugar cola a day, would they be able to have a whole serving of it, and or would that even be putting them over the recommended limit?
Yeah, that would probably be putting them over the recommended limit. Because if you think of 10, I know all these numbers are very confusing to translate to your daily life, but, you know, the average person needs about 2,000 calories a day. So 10% of that would be 200 calories a day, and that's kind of, you shouldn't go over that in sugar. And what we're talking about here is added sugar. We're not talking about the natural sugar found in things like fruits or vegetables or grains. We're talking about when they actually add sugar to something like a soda or to yogurt or a candy bar or a granola bar. So, you know, the budget is 200 calories for the average person. Now, if you require less than 2,000 calories a day, which many older people or younger people even do not require 2,000 calories a day, that brings it down even more. So, you know, you can, there's about, there are 4 grams of carbohydrates in sugar, so it's kind of like doing the math to look at how many calories are coming from sugar on labels, so it's a little bit of a confusion there. But, you know, looking at keeping that budget down to that, to no more than 200 calories from the average person's diet coming from sugar is really what they're recommending.
Well, so it seems like there's a shortcut for the average person then to be in line with the dietary guidelines, and that is stop drinking soft drinks.
Yeah.
And they weren't that bold. I mean, there's certainly a few initiatives around the country that are trying to limit or tax soft drinks. But still, when you get right down to it, with the focus on what they're trying to accomplish and the sugar, it seems like that's something somebody can, you know, if they have no other choice and they feel like because of their schedule and everything, they're even listening to our discussion right now when they're in a drive-through window, asking for water or coffee or iced tea or what, even skim milk, is going to be better than any cola that they might order. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think there's a huge emphasis on sugar-sweetened beverages right now because the research is showing that so when you consume sugar-sweetened beverages, you don't gain any sense of satiety. You just drink that, and then you eat the same amount of calories at that meal. It's something about the chewing action. When you actually eat foods, you gain more of a satiety value, the sense of fullness or appreciation of that food. So there's a lot of concern, and then there's a lot of research that has linked sugar-sweetened beverages with obesity and type 2 diabetes. So this is a huge issue. It's coming out more and more that we have to be really careful about these sugar-sweetened beverages. Although we have sugar in other things, too. The way I look at these recommendations and in order to follow them is to try to avoid sugar in things that don't really contribute anything. For instance, reading the labels to make sure they don't add sugar to your favorite breakfast cereal or to, you know, using, like when I enjoy yogurt, I use plain yogurt and I add fruit as my natural sweetener. I don't need to buy the pre-sweetened, yogurts, which can have just as much, sugar as a can of soda.
Really?
So it's these, yeah, some of them can have that much. So, you know, it's these hidden sources of sugar that can really put you over your daily limit. And that way, when you really want to enjoy some things, like, you know, like a cookie or, you know, a homemade apple pie or something like that, you know, you're saving your sugar for something that you enjoy on an occasional basis rather than all these little hidden sources that don't really contribute anything to your, you know, to your quality of food.
It's kind of sneaky how it gets into so many different foods. Obviously, it makes it taste better, so people want to eat more of it if they're getting sugar. But you know, you think back when there was the initial pressure against fats, and we went through a trend of having low fat this and low fat that, but there were sugars kind of hidden instead, so people were getting calories even though they were, you know, having some low fat product, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so
yes.
This is another, just creeps up. And that another sort of misunderstanding back to the sugar. You hear some people now almost promoting cane sugar as if it's a health food because it's not coming from corn.
Mm-hmm.
That must be frustrating for a dietitian to hear.
Yes, people don't realize that, you know, there's many forms of sugar, and there's such a backlash on high fructose corn syrup now, and rightly so. It's in many ingredients that are very low quality, and it's hidden. It's a very easy source of sugar that's added to foods and beverages. But there are many sources of added sugars, and if you look at the added sugars that we should be avoiding, they include things like honey, as you say, cane sugar, brown rice syrup. There are so many different forms of sugar that can be added to the label. So you really have to watch for all of this. One of the things that's confusing is that when you look at a nutrition facts label on a food product, there's a section for sugar in grams. But right now, that label includes the natural sugar found in foods. And many foods contain natural sugar. And those are not the ones we need to worry about. So you could pick up something like frozen fruit, and it could say that there are 15 grams of sugar or 10 grams of sugar or something in that product. But that's natural sugar, and those are the sugars we don't need to worry about. So the FDA is changing the labeling on food products so that there will be a line for added sugar. So it'll be easier for us to tell, you know, whether this sugar is naturally found in the product or if it's added. So this is something that's coming out. It's not out there yet, but it will be coming, and that will make it a lot easier for consumers.
You know, this seems like it's a no-brainer that this shouldn't be controversial, but I suppose there are people that don't want to see sugar targeted. I'm not sure who those people are, unless they're sugar producers. But is it just pretty well accepted by almost everyone that it's fair to try to target sugar this aggressively, or is it controversial in any way?
I don't know if it's that controversial. I think that most people in the health and nutrition world welcome this, but I also think that it needs to come along with more understanding. That people may think, oh, I don't eat that much sugar, but if they really looked at what they're getting, they'd be shocked at how much sugar they really are getting. And I think that's the thing that needs to be understood. Like, how can we get people there? How can we get people to reduce to 10%? And, you know, another consideration that a lot of people think about is it's not only just a negative idea that the sugar is linked to health problems like type 2 diabetes and obesity and maybe even cardiovascular risks. It's not just that, but when you eat so much sugar as part of your diet, you're crowding out healthy foods. So here we're saying you could have 10% of your diet in sugar, but that means that you're wasting 10% of your calories on basically nothing. There's no nutrient value in those sugar grams. So, you know, by asking Americans to cut back their sugar, they're going to be including more high-quality foods to make up those calories, and that's really an important message because, you know, by having more high-quality foods, then you have more nutrients in your diet, and we don't get enough of many major nutrients.
Well, you know, one other piece of good news in the report, I mean, some people would view the sugar as not such good news if they're looking for excuses to keep having a lot of sweet beverages, but you know, I agree with you. I think others are going to jump on that bandwagon pretty fast. But the other piece of good news I hear is that coffee's not discouraged. That people can, in fact, where before they might have been saying it's okay to have a cup or two of coffee, they're saying that you can have more than a cup or two of coffee. Have several cups of coffee, and it's probably good for most people. Is that right?
Yeah. It wasn't particularly highlighted, but you're right. There's no recommendation to decrease coffee consumption. In fact, most of the research in the last several years has been very positive about coffee consumption. So, you know, it's actually a positive thing. So that, in my mind, I think that makes it easier to reduce your sugar because, you know, we can have more things like coffee and tea, which now we understand are healthful beverages. So coffee, tea, water, those are the beverages we should be going to, as long as we're not, like, adding lots of sugar to those beverages, you know.
You know, I think we might be remiss in reviewing this dietary guidelines if we didn't bring up a controversy that was kind of around the whole development of the dietary guidelines. And that I'm talking about the committee report was recommending consideration of the environmental impact of foods you consume. And correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but it seemed like there was quite a bit of discussion and some presentations and that part of the dietary guidelines should take into account the environmental footprint, if you will, of various foods. And then there was a huge reaction from various groups when that was part of the report back to the secretaries of HHS and USDA. And then the secretaries said, no, that really doesn't belong part of this report. And then there's been a lot of conversation. Did I get that right, Sharon, or do you
read
it differently?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good assessment of what happened. Yes, you know, for the first time, the committee actually thought that sustainability should be a factor in the dietary guidelines. So it was quite revolutionary, you know, that the original committee report included a discussion about sustainability and actually some recommendations that would make the food system more sustainable. But then those did not make it into the final dietary guidelines because, from my understanding, it was decided that it was kind of out of the scope of the nutritional guidance, that sustainability at this point is out of that whole scope. So that was a little bit disappointing because I think that would have been interesting to see how we could have included that in the guideline.
Do other countries have dietary guidelines, and do they include sustainability in their guidelines?
Other countries do have their own set of guidelines. In fact, our guidelines are a huge thing around the world. Everybody is looking at what we're doing because they will reference them, and they may use part of our evidence analysis in their own development of guidelines. So, but I'm not quite sure if any of them have successfully included sustainability in their guidelines. My plate was already updated today, too, which I was surprised. I thought there might be a little lag. But I studied it, and I didn't see any dramatic changes. The graphic image looks exactly the same. And when you look at the individual food groups, I didn't see any major changes there. So, the whole website looks vastly different. It has a different access point, and it's, you know, much more, has much more information and tools. But at first blush, it looks very similar to the last version.
So, if people want to take a look at how they might be able to use the information, though, and start seeing it graphically, they should go to MyPlate. And how do they find it? Where's the when they look online and they want to see what MyPlate is recommending for their diet? How do they find it?
So if you go to choosemyplate.gov, you'll see the entire website. You can even see the dietary guidelines there too.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much. I tell you, this has been a great conversation with you today, and I can't think of anyone I would rather visit with about the dietary guidelines than Sharon Palmer.
Join us again as we talk about my favorite subject, the food on our tables.